Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how skin color shapes life for Asian Americans. We'll spend this hour with sociologist Nikki Khanna, who asked Asian American women for personal essays on their experiences with colorism, a hierarchy that grants or denies social status based on physical appearance. In some places, that means women are pressured to chemically bleach their skin or have their eyelids surgically altered. To some observers, this might look like Asian Americans want to look more white, but as Khanna will explain, the forces of colorism are far more complex than that. Also, white people, not everything is about us. Conversation starts after a short break. Drugstore makeup aisles are stocked with competing brands of something called whitening cream, chemical skin lotion that promises to fade skin to some lighter shade held up as the standard of beauty. Actors and models in places like India, Thailand, and China tend to have lighter than average complexions. And from a young age, some girls are encouraged to carefully protect themselves from the sun. How did that lighter is better aesthetic originate in Asia, and how does it affect American women of Asian descent? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We've talked many times on this show about the insidious effects of racism on the well-being of non-white people. Today we're going to talk about colorism, a kind of bias based on skin tone that can exist among people who share a similar racial or ethnic identity. As my guest will tell us, it's a very complicated subject and one not everybody is comfortable talking about. But she found dozens of women who were eager to share their personal experiences, which she has collected in a fascinating, wide-ranging new book of essays. Nikki Khanna is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of the book Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. Nikki, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
What is the difference between racism and colorism, and where's the overlap?
So there is a clear difference, but as you said, there is some overlap. So racism is obviously something that we see occurring between racial groups. When we think about colorism in particular, it's skin color discrimination that occurs within racial groups. So among African Americans, among Asian Americans, we can even see it between ethnic groups. So for example, lighter-skinned Asian ethnic groups, such as those who are Chinese, discriminating against darker-skinned Asian ethnic groups who might be Cambodian or Indian. But this is where it gets a little bit complicated. There is some overlap with racism in that colorism can also be interracial as well. So one example that I give in the book is when Barack Obama ran for his first term of presidency, Harry Reid, at the time, Senator Harry Reid, who was a Democrat, made a comment that Barack Obama basically would be a good candidate because he said something like he spoke well and he was light skinned. Hmm. So we can even see from other racial groups this preference for lighter skinned people of color as well. So it's a pretty complicated topic, but generally scholars talk about colorism as something occurring within racial groups.
So you first sensed that skin color must matter in some way when you were a kid growing up outside Atlanta. Your family would shop in an Indian grocery store. What did you find there that captured your attention?
Yeah, so it's interesting. When I look back to my childhood, I'm not sure exactly where that message came from, that lighter skin is better. I look back and I think as young as maybe 4 or 5, I already knew this to be true. And part of it was growing up in the larger United States, where certainly there was this lighter is better message more broadly in American culture. But in Indian culture, I also knew that to be true. So we would go every weekend to the Indian grocer and just waiting in line or, you know, shopping in that grocery store, there would always be these skin whitening products. The one product I always remember seeing that is probably one of the most famous in South Asia is Fair and Lovely. And, you know, the term Fair and Lovely, even the label of this product is pretty blatant, right? So to be beautiful, you have light or quote unquote fair skin. But I remember I would look at these boxes and on the side of the boxes, they would have a skin scale gradient that I believe was like seven different shades. And I would compare my skin color next to these shades to see how my skin color compared. So I was very aware of these products early on. But I think my understanding about light skin being somehow seen as better or superior to dark skin was even separate and apart from that as well.
So your mom is white, is that correct?
Right.
Did it occur to you to wonder why fair skin was thought to be more attractive? I imagine your father, who's Indian American, had darker skin than your mother, and you love them
Right.
equally.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad has certainly much darker skin than my mom. My mom is blonde haired, blue eyed, and very light skinned. My dad's from India. I'm not sure exactly where I learned that message early on. I know that there were family stories even when I was really young about my great grandmother had blue eyes, and this was talked about as a really prized thing that she had blue eyes. And many of my second and third cousins in India have blue eyes today. And the way it's talked about is in such a sort of elevated way that it was like family lore. Oh my gosh, they have blue eyes. I already knew there was some attachment or some sort of pedestal that these characteristics were being placed on. And a lot of the family conversations, even today, go back to, well, maybe we had there was a German ancestor, or maybe there was somebody from, some part of Europe. And it's sort of revered within our family to think about having an ancestor who was white. And I think our family's not alone. I think that's pretty common to have that sort of elevation placed on whiteness.
Some people have pointed out that many white people like to tan and that tan skin is considered attractive, which would seem to suggest that American culture actually somehow prefers darker skin. Can you talk about why this preference does not benefit whose people is naturally skin, people whose skin is naturally more brown all the time?
Yeah, so I think, that's a really interesting statement. So when I would talk to people, and even today when I talk to people about my research and I talk about colorism, first of all, a lot of people don't understand it, or they'll say things like, oh, I had no idea that this was even an issue among Asian Americans or among Asian communities. But one thing that a lot of people will say, especially if they're white, is, well, I like to tan. We like to have dark skin, you like to have light skin. I guess we all just want what we don't have. But it's really a false parity. It's not the same thing, even though we might on the surface see them as the same thing, as just wanting something different than what we have. When people use whitening creams or whitening soaps, or, there's so many different products on the market. I mean, moisturizers, foundations, sunscreens, all sorts of things to attain lighter skin. They're doing it to access social mobility. They're doing it because they're trying to open up opportunities for themselves, like make them more attractive in the marriage market or help them get that job or promotion. When women in the West, in particular white women, tan, they're not doing that for the same reason. There might be some beauty norms attached to having a temporarily tan skin tone. And I actually talk about this quite a bit in this book as well with regard to my own experience. I talk about being light skinned, but I would get really dark in the summer, and I would get a lot of praise from white friends for, oh, you get so dark so quickly. And that's different though. Whenever I temporarily get tanned in the summer, that's different than the experience my father has, or my Indian cousins or my Indian grandparents for having been born with brown skin. I think there's a limit to how tolerant we might be to skin shade, whether it's a temporarily tan skin or someone who is brown skin. That's just who they are. There's a lot of negative stereotypes that come along with that. So whenever I would tan, I would get praise, and there would be no negative stereotypes that would be attached to that because I knew it was just a slightly tanned. It would be gone in a while, as compared to, for example, what my father, what his experiences have been in the United States.
Your focus here is on Asian American women's experience with the way skin color is perceived. I mean, colorism is a big topic regardless, but talk about why you wanted to focus in this work on women.
So, I talk about this quite a bit in the book, but colorism is something that affects everybody of all genders. And there's no doubt about that. But it's women who actually bear the brunt of colorism. Because light skin is linked in many Asian communities, it's linked to things like intelligence and trustworthiness and dependability and, all these sort of positive characteristics. But for women, there's this added layer of it's also linked to beauty and femininity. And so women, especially women on the marriage market, having light skin is social capital. It's an asset to have. One of the things I talk about in the book is even among Indian Americans in this country, you would see this preference for light skin. So many Indian American marriages, not all, are arranged by parents. And I, when I was growing up, would read the India Abroad, which was a paper that served the Indian American community. And there were all these marital ads that parents would place for their adult children. And they would, talk about how, my son, He's smart. He went to Harvard. He's attractive. He's this or that. But if it was a woman, they would oftentimes say, if the woman was light skinned, that she's fair. She's beautiful and fair. She's beautiful and Weedish. And Weedish was a term, or is a term, that Indians and Indian Americans use to say she has a skin the color of wheat, which is prize. It's light skin. So I wanted to focus specifically on women, knowing that it also affected men. And just as an aside, my father's been reading this book the past couple of days, and I keep getting texts from him. And even though it's about women, he's like, "Oh, I totally identified with this." So it's making me laugh because I do think it's still applicable to men's experiences, but there are some things that he's not going to identify with, and particularly that has to do with being on the marriage market and sort of the attractiveness to the opposite sex. And I'll also just add that the majority of the women in the book were heterosexual. So we don't exactly know just yet how this affects women of other sexual orientations as well. So future research.
So, what do we know about the extent to which colorism among Asian Americans can be attributed to the effects of European colonialism in the countries their families originated in?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm looking at Asian American women whose ancestries come from a lot of different places in Asia, India, the Philippines, Korea, China, Japan, so on and so forth. And it really depends on the context of where their families come from. And there's a lot of historical, or there's a lot of debate among historians about where this actually came from. So in some societies, for example, in Japan and China, it's very likely that this preference for light skin predated any contact with Europeans. In India, historians argue that perhaps even before Europeans colonized India, there was already a preference for light skin. But there's a debate. But one thing we do know is in those countries, in particular in those countries that are post-colonial countries, they were certainly affected by being colonized by Europeans. So for India, for example, we see the British there for hundreds of years. And when the British were there, there might have already been a preference for light skin in that society. But when the British were there, they further elevated whiteness. So, for example, they made comparisons between Indians who had light skin and dark skin, saying that the light-skinned Indians were smarter. They were more capable. They oftentimes gave them more desirable jobs, for example, within the colonial government, whereas those with darker skin got more menial jobs. So there were these invidious comparisons being made by the colonists. And I argue, and many other historians argue, that even when they left, those comparisons remained. That preference for light skin remained in the country.
Do Asians who live in Asia associate white phenotypes with looking American?
So again, it really, I think, depends on the country. So, some people make arguments that, hey, my family's from China, and having light skin has nothing to do with Europeans or whiteness. It has to do with looking wealthy. And in many societies throughout Asia, having light skin has nothing to do necessarily with whiteness, but has everything to do with social class. So, having light skin meant that you were privileged enough to perhaps not work, or you worked indoors versus those with darker skin who had to work out in the field. So skin color was an indicator of one's social class. But other societies, we would say it's certainly linked to whiteness. And I think my family is a really good example of that. So thinking about the lore over the stories over the blue eyes in our family and how much it's talked about as perhaps being connected to Europeanness, and the pride with which that's talked about as well, I think is pretty telling.
You did not find that a lot of your essayists expressed any particular desire to look or be white. Some acknowledge that they might have a desire to enjoy something like white privilege.
Right.
Do Asian American women experience a kind of social pressure to blend into white culture?
I think absolutely. And I think women in this book, some of them actually talked about that this pressure of not feeling othered. So women in the book talked about growing up in the United States or immigrating to the United States and being called racial slurs or discriminated in some way, and really just wanting to blend in with their classmates, to look like their classmates. And even I, with a white mother and an Indian father, like I think people look at me and they, for the most part, probably see me as a white woman. But I think even I was very much influenced by these sort of broader American society norms to want to be lighter skinned
My guest is Nikki Khanna. She's associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of the new book, Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. My guest this hour is Nikki Khanna, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of the book Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. Nikki, what evidence have you found that the experience of colorism among Asian Americans might be tied to their experience as witnesses to anti-Black racism in this country?
So I think it's really difficult to get at that, and primarily because we know that anti-Blackness, through research, we know that anti-Blackness runs rampant in many Asian American communities. But to what extent people are willing to talk about that and that connection is oftentimes difficult to get at. Clearly, they have to be related, and certainly for Asian Americans in particular, because as Asians immigrate to the United States, we certainly see anti-Blackness sometimes coming over in the baggage with them from Asia. Anti-Blackness does exist in Asia. We also see Asian Americans in the United States, or those new immigrants in the United States, learning anti-Blackness in this culture right here in the United States of America. And we can certainly see there's likely a link, so that disdain for dark skin can see, we might be able to see it manifest itself in that sort of that self-disdain for our own dark skin as well. So likely there certainly is a connection, and that's problematic.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Jean on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Jean. And Chris, is always a great program. I know your focus today, the speaker's focus is on Asian women. However, I'm African American, and we have a similar issue in our culture. Growing up, I was always told by my parents I was called high yellow, and I am very light-skinned. However, one of the things my parents talked about that was an issue when they were growing up was called the paper bag test. And literally, if they were going, particularly to social functions, there would be someone that would stand at the door with a paper bag. And if you were the color of or lighter than the paper bag, you were granted admittance. However, if you were not, you were not allowed to enter this particular event. I was wondering for your guests, is there anything analogous in the Asian culture? And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks for calling.
That's such a good question. You know, I actually do write quite a bit in this book also about the experiences of other racial groups. And I think the most research on colorism, certainly within the United States, is on African Americans. The paper bag test is certainly interesting. And I thank the caller for calling in and sharing that experience of her parents, because it was used to keep people out who were darker than that paper bag out of elite social clubs, even fraternities and sororities, churches, business organizations, so on and so forth. To my knowledge, I don't know of something that is as physically real as a paper bag in Asian communities, in particular in Asia, and I certainly haven't seen it in Asian American communities. I think the only thing I can say in terms of any parallel is just the language we use, in particular through arranged marriage, when we include, you know, Indians talk about bio data. You have your bio data. It's sort of like your resume that your parents or that you and your parents will put together to attract a potential mate. And just using that sort of language. Another example, I think, sort of with regard to that language is in India in particular, and I would hazard a guess that this isn't just in India, but there is a dating website or a marital matrimonial website where, you know, you just like here in the United States, you put in information about, you know, your gender, the things you're looking for, maybe your educational background. They have also included up until recently your skin shade, and you would click a box on what your skin shade was, so that if I, for example, was going to go onto this website, I could then filter out all the people who were light or dark skin, depending on what I preferred. And typically, you know, the cultural bias is for light skin. So I could literally click on a box and click out anyone who, you know, said that they had dark skin. So that's the only comparison I can think of. But the paper bag test is certainly such a big part of American history and certainly other societies around the world.
When one is a member of a group that has been historically marginalized by the dominant white supremacist society, I can understand, you know, a reluctance to talk about something uncomfortable within that society, something that might reflect to some people what looks like a form of racism. Can you talk about the comfort or discomfort with which people discuss colorism within Asian American communities?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's an open secret. It's not something we oftentimes talk about. We might talk about it between mothers and daughters, for example, or grandmothers and granddaughters, because it's, like a stay out of the sun, make sure you wear a hat, use sunblock. It's that sort of messaging. But talking about the problem of colorism is something different. I don't think I've really had many honest conversations with family members because it's kind of embarrassing in a way too to bring it up. It's one thing to say, or you hear your aunt say to your cousin, make sure you have a hat on, but it's another to sort of talk more openly about it. So my hope with this book is that it does open up conversations. I think even between me and my father, with me sharing this book with him, has opened up some conversations for us that we wouldn't have otherwise talked about.
Your father, when you wanted to get a tan before your wedding, was like, "What are you doing?"
And he was just genuinely, I think, perplexed, confused. It wasn't like he was saying to me, oh, don't do this. And, he was upset. It was just, his brain, he was trying to wrap his brain around why his daughter would be trying to get a tan before her wedding. And I'll just say this for listeners. I talk about this in the book because I can tan nicely in the summer, but in the winter I'm like a sallow yellow. It's awful. And so I said to my father, like, I don't want to be the same color as my wedding dress as I walk down the aisle. So he was really just trying to put it together because he grew up in a very different culture where it was this really overemphasis on having light skin. And so to see his daughter actively trying to darken her skin, especially before her wedding, right? That's this really important day in your life where all the family's going to be there. He just was genuinely perplexed.
Some of these essays address the ways in which colorism that works in the other direction can also be painful, which is to say, someone whose skin looks lighter than what's seen as typical for their group, and then they're perceived as somehow not fully belonging.
Yeah, I think this is something that other groups experience as well. And I talked about this a little bit in the book with regard to African Americans, that light skin is certainly privileged in that community, but having light skin can also be a disadvantage because you're seen as not black enough, not authentic enough. But this can also operate in certain Asian ethnic groups in particular, where in those Asian ethnic groups where dark skin is more the stereotypical norm, so among Filipinos and Indians. So having skin that's really light is certainly prized, but there's a limit to that. And one of the essays in particular, I think, really bears this out. And this is a woman who was born with albinism. And she talks about how she was born with really light skin, blonde hair, and blue eyes. And this is posed quite a problem for her in terms of fitting in and feeling connected with other Indian Americans. And culturally wise, she feels a great connection in terms of the music and the movies and the clothes. She's sort of very much within that culture, but really struggles with feeling marginalized by other Indians because she looks so different. So I think her essay was very interesting because we always talk about light skin as being privileged and advantaged, but she's like, hey, hold on, there's a limit. And her story was an example of that.
You mentioned eyelid surgery in the book, which is a procedure to create a fold in the eyelid that doesn't always occur naturally in people of East Asian heritage. Julie Chen, the TV anchor, was pressured by her news director and also by her agent to get this done.
Yeah, I think there's sort of two points I want to make about that is colorism is more than just skin color. When we talk about colorism, it's certainly, it's colorism. We sort of think about skin color, but it's also about those other physical traits that may approximate Europeanness or whiteness. So having, as I mentioned before, blue eyes or double-lidded eyes, which is prevalent among European Americans, but I believe is only prevalent among like 15% of East Asians. So, and also, your nose shape and other physical features such as that. But I think Julie Chen's story really illustrates the pressures that Asian American women face, not only from their ethnic communities, but in the larger United States as well, in particular from other whites. So she talked about how a news director, a white news director, said to her that, she should get her eyes done. And a white talent agent basically said, I'm not gonna represent you unless you get your eyes done and have bigger eyes. So there's this pressure from whites as well to have these more European looking qualities that places a lot of pressure on women.
Has she regretted that decision?
I haven't heard her say she's regretted that decision. And in fact, I do know, and I write about this in the book, that she, acknowledges that her career really took off after she had this eyelid surgery. So I really think that speaks to, again, the pressures within Asian ethnic communities, but also in the United States, to have these very Eurocentric looking physical qualities.
There may be women who have that surgery who say they're not trying to look European. Is it possible to draw the line between a cosmetic procedure that people might get because of personal preference as opposed to one that they want because of some kind of pervasive cultural pressure?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think this is an internal debate among many Asian American women as to why they're having these surgeries. You know, some women will say, I never wanted to look white. It was never about that. It was about looking like a more beautiful version of myself or a beautiful Asian. And there's actually one quote in the book that I have in front of me where one of the women wrote in an op-ed piece about having her eyelid surgery. And she said, you know, other white people were asking her, is it because you wanted to look white? And she says, is that a symptom of in-group narcissism that white people are always assuming we want to look like them?
Right.
And so that made me laugh as well. And you know, that was her feeling on it. She said, I wasn't trying to approximate a white appearance. I didn't do this for other white people. I did it for myself. And she's like, white people didn't even notice I had it done. My Asian friends noticed, but white people didn't. However, I will say there are other scholars who research in this area that say it's not a coincidence that what is the beauty standard in many Asian ethnic groups just happens to resemble, you know, Caucasian standards of beauty, that is no coincidence. So I will just leave it as it's an ongoing debate.
One of the things you did as part of your research was to look at ads in some Asian countries, and they often feature actresses of European descent or mixed heritage.
Yeah, so that's actually pretty common in India, in South Korea, in Taiwan, where you would see ads for perhaps whitening creams or whitening serums, but also even in ads for, you know, fashion ads for clothing or ads for your sunglasses or, you know, electronics, even using either light-skinned Asian models or Caucasian models or mixed race models who have some degree of white ancestry. And I'll say even when I was growing up, I would watch Bollywood movies with my dad. So these are these Indian movies that came out of Bombay, which is now Mumbai. And it was very clear to me that the people on the screen did not look like anybody I knew. They were all light skinned, all had light colored eyes. You know, they just did not represent the Indian masses in any way or anyone in my family. So, you know, turning on the TV throughout Asia, you're likely going to see light skinned television hosts, actors and actresses and movie stars. And that's just the way it is. And that adds to that pressure you know, on Asians to have this sort of appearance.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there pushback? Is there starting to be pushback against this in those Asian countries? I mean, there's no particular reason why. I mean, Emma Watson is a beautiful woman, but she doesn't need to be the standard of beauty in India or Thailand.
Yeah, so yeah, Emma Watson is a really good example. So she was the face of a whitening serum for Lancome that was marketed throughout Asia. And I remember reading the comments online, and I remember laughing because one person said, you know, how white does she want to be, right? This is a white woman. So, yes, there is pushback. I think that we've seen, particularly in the last 10 years, maybe even really just in the last 7 or 8 years, some social media campaigns that I think have been really powerful coming out of South Asia. I have really haven't seen parallels yet or parallel campaigns in East Asia yet, even though this is just as much of a problem in East Asia as well. But one example came out of India. It was a Dark is Beautiful campaign led by a famous Bollywood actress. So that was pretty powerful to have this Bollywood actress who talked about her own experiences of camera persons telling her to lighten her skin. And so she speaks out against this preference for light skin. One out of Pakistan, Dark is Divine. And this one was started by a woman named Fatima Lodi. And this one really stood out for me because she said when she started this phrase, Dark is Divine, in this particular campaign, she said so many women came up to her and they were completely confused by the message. And she said they would say to her things like, wait, what? Like, dark complexion can be beautiful? How is dark divine? They didn't even understand the message. So I feel like we're still in the really early stages of challenging this messaging, but it's starting to happen. It's absolutely starting to happen. And in fact, Fair and Lovely that I just mentioned earlier, Unilever is the owner of that company, this whitening cream, and I know that they're starting to make changes to the names of some of these products, including Fair and Lovely. However, I'll say they're not going far enough. I think they're just changing it to Glow and Lovely. So we have a long way to go.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Nicole on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
So my question is, your caller mentioned a few minutes back that there was an anti-black sentiment in the Asian community, and I was wondering if she knew the origin of that anti-black sentiment in either South Asia or East Asia.
Thanks for calling.
That is such a good question, and I'm not even sure I can answer that. I write quite a bit about anti-blackness in parts of Asia, and I don't want to paint all of Asia as this anti-black, entire continent because that's not true either. But there definitely is a problem with anti-blackness, the same as it's a problem in places like China or South Korea with darker-skinned Asian ethnic groups who migrate there. So I know that Filipinos, for example, face a lot of prejudice in South Korea. So where it comes from, I'm not sure, but it's absolutely a problem. I know that African Americans living in parts of Asia have talked about the discrimination they face, people moving away from them, for example, on the subway or taxi drivers refusing to pick them up. So it exists. Where it comes from, I don't know. I think that's such a great question. But I do talk also about anti-blackness among Asian Americans. And we certainly know partly where that comes from. They're bringing it from Asia, but also learning it right here in the United States once they arrive.
Is there some relationship between the model minority status ascribed to many Asian Americans and anti-black racism?
Absolutely. So the model minority stereotype is seemingly pretty positive, right? It's this idea that Asians are successful because they work hard, they're smart, they put their head down, they don't complain, they study hard. So it sounds like a really great stereotype. The problem is, it's a myth. Asian American groups vary quite substantially in their achievements in the United States. There are some groups that have very, sort of stellar incomes and education, but that's not the same of all groups. So maybe I'll just stop here.
All right, we'll pick that up in a moment. My guest is Nikki
Okay.
Khanna, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of the new essay collection, Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. I'm Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Nikki Khanna, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of a collection of essays called Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. You were still, it sounded like, in the middle of talking about the model minority status stereotype of Asian Americans in this country and its relationship to anti-black racism. You were saying, for one thing, it's not accurate to assume that all Asian Americans do very well compared to their other American peers. Certain groups really struggle in this country.
Yeah, some groups really struggle, and so it really is a myth. I think there are some groups in particular, if they came as refugees, are really struggling. And there are some Asian ethnic groups that are show very high rates of poverty, even more so than their African American counterparts or Latinx counterparts. So it's certainly a myth, but it still gives a message that, okay, all Asians are successful, and so if they are successful and other groups are not, there must be something wrong with those other groups. Maybe they're lazy, they're not working as hard. And so it feeds anti-blackness. I think one of the functions of the model minority myth is to be divisive among people of color. So, hey, we're doing really well. So, black people or Latinx people, if they're not doing well, it must be their own fault. But it's a myth. And I think people really need to understand it's a myth. And one other thing I would add is some of the Asian ethnic groups that are doing really well, such as the Indians, for example, or Filipinos, there were very selective immigration laws that allowed for highly educated members of those groups to immigrate to the US. So we're already talking about a pretty selective group, while at the same time we're ignoring years of institutional discrimination and systemic racism against African Americans.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Patrick is calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I was wondering if the author would acknowledge that virtually universal discrimination by economic class, as in the Japanese culture, as well as simplified in James Clavell's classic novel, Shogun, is just as significant a factor in prejudicial behavior as the so-called blamed on Europeans colorism.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the effect of social class discrimination, Nikki.
I think what he's saying, I mean, he's saying something that's really important, because one of the things that does come out in the book is that, yes, some of this has to do with contact with Europeans, but some of it just has to do with social class and skin color being intertwined with social class. So as I mentioned before, people with light skin were historically in many societies, for example, like China and Japan, they were of the higher classes because they didn't necessarily have to work or they didn't have to work outdoors, whereas the darker skinned individuals were the farmers. They worked out in the hot sun. So there is a social class element. So in many societies, skin color acts basically as an indicator of social class. So we certainly can't take out social class from our understanding of colorism. It's certainly part and parcel of colorism.
What did you learn about how colorism plays out within families where parents or siblings might have very different skin tones, even if they all belong to the same group?
Yeah, I mean, that happens quite a bit. And I think many of the women in the book talk about those experiences of being lighter skinned or darker skinned than their siblings. I know that one essayist sort of talked about a little bit of the guilt she felt, because when every time someone gave her a compliment and they ignored her sister, she understood why. Or the flip side of that is, you know, the sister got all the attention, was seen as beautiful, and the other sibling really, you know, struggled with being the darker skinned or sort of the less seen as a less attractive sibling. There was one story in particular where the writer talks about her sister as all the family members always referred to her as Little Miss America. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, you know, I think that there's a whole dynamic of siblings anyway, especially among female siblings, it might already be occurring. But that added layer of beauty being predicated upon skin shade has been pretty problematic for many of the women in the book.
I also was thinking while reading this book about the pressure we put on everyone, but women in particular, to be beautiful. Like, why is that so important?
Yeah, I mean, preaching to the choir, right? This is a worldwide issue of the pressure we place on women for beauty. And I think the parallel I can make is we might look at whitening creams and whitening products as filling department stores and drug stores throughout Asia, but we see that just as many products in the United States, although the focus might not be whitening, but is anti-aging or, you know, look younger, or, you know, smooth out your wrinkles, right? So this is a global issue, which makes it pretty important to look at among women.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Austin, Texas, where Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I grew up in Mexico City from my I guess what you call an upper middle class family. And from a very early age, I noticed all the upper class jobs, the leaders of the country, business leaders, that sort of thing. They're very light skinned, more European looking, they're taller, and all the lower jobs, the people who picked up the garbage, this kind of thing. They're much, much more Indian origin. And your caller, she's right on point, and I like to have her. This is kind of also an open secret, I guess you'd say.
Thanks.
She'd give me your input. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for calling. And Mark, I presume, just to clarify, because of the conversation we're having, when you say Indian origin, you mean Mexican Indian, Native Mexican.
Indigenous.
Yeah.
That is indigenous. That is correct.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. What do you know about that, Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, it's a worldwide issue. One of the things that's really interesting that I was actually just describing to a friend the other day is when I started graduate school, I was interested in this topic. And I mentioned this to a colleague, a tenured colleague at that point. And that colleague was like, nah, that's not a good topic. Like, that's, you know, I think he couldn't see the importance of the topic. And he saw that I was interested in Asian Americans and thought maybe that's not really something that's going to be really seen as that important. But I think now looking back on that, I don't think he understood how global this problem is. So I'm talking about it within the context of Asian Americans and those of Asian descent, but it's much broader than that. As your earlier callers have also pointed to, this is a problem among Asian Americans. It's a problem throughout Latin America, the Middle East, Africa. So this isn't really just a problem that is just about Asian Americans. It's a much broader problem. And I appreciate the caller pointing out that in Mexico, we see this skin color gradient in terms of who's in positions of power. If you look at Mexico and who the politicians are, if you look at Brazil and who the politicians are, India, you'll see that the majority of those people are lighter skinned. And so we can see it's a much bigger issue than just Asian Americans alone.
Knowing that colorism is an issue, I wonder if for some people, pregnancy is fraught, wondering sort of what skin tone your child might have and how that might affect their outcomes in life.
Yes, so absolutely. So yeah, parents, so if I can remember and I'll keep my train of thought here, there's two things I want to say about that. One thing is I talk about that in India, there's been a trend for parents who are undergoing in vitro fertilization to seek out white donor eggs. And one of the fathers that I quote in the book, he talks about why they're doing that. He says, because it's much easier to get fairer girls married. Hmm. And so there's a cultural pressure of, I want to get my daughter married and I want her to marry well. So, you know, please let her be light skinned. And going as far as looking for white donor eggs is primarily coming, these donor eggs from Eastern Europe. But also, I know within my own community of stories among friends whose mothers have told me, I never drank one cup of coffee during my pregnancy because I worried that it would make you darker skinned. You know, and these are educated women. They know that that's not true, but they don't want to take the chance. Or I drank lots of milk. Or I learned from my mother that I should bathe my baby in milk when she's born because that will make her lighter skinned. So even among the most educated women, these sorts of old wives' tales are sort of playing out because it's that pressure of having lighter-skinned children.
Yeah, it has to be really vexing when you don't necessarily want to contribute to those kinds of stereotypes, but you know that they're going to continue to exist and perhaps pervade the consciousness of your children.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think many of the women in the book talked about the pressure coming directly from mothers and grandmothers to stay out of the sun, to wear sunscreen, to use whitening creams. And it wasn't because their mothers were evil. Their mothers grew up in this culture where they understand how it works and they want their daughters to be successful. They want them to marry well, so to say, or they want them to get the job. And, you know, so they've learned to operate within these sort of cultural pressures. And it's unfortunate that it's getting passed from one generation to the next, but that's how it's happening.
All right, let's go back to the phones, this time to Lexington, Kentucky. Monica is on the line. Hi, Monica.
Hi. My husband and I were in India in 1998, right when Titanic came out. And we saw a billboard, a big hand-painted billboard of Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. And the Indian artist had depicted them much chubbier than they were in real life, much fuller face.
That's interesting.
And I wondered if the author had found that ideals of weight, you know, being heavier or lighter, thinner, fatter, were also culturally ingrained. I'm wondering if it had to do with like amount of food to eat or showing that you're wealthy, or just wondered in addition to colorism, if kind of prejudice towards weight has come up in any of her research.
Thanks for calling.
That is such a great question, and I'm not going to pretend to be the expert on this, but I'm absolutely fascinated by that example. I know certainly historically speaking, you know, having a greater girth, so to say, was an indicator of, you know, you were wealthy, you were provided for, you had access to food. It's interesting that that was in 1998, and I don't really know, and I would be interested to see if that really is a pattern across India. Certainly when we talk about beauty norms in the West, especially in the United States, it is about being very thin, and that's not culturally shared around the world. So thank you for that example.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You seem pretty intrepid in terms of exploring things, whether they're comfortable to talk about or not, Nikki. I wonder if any part of you worried that this kind of research gives fuel to people who are white supremacists who want to say, see, everybody has issues with skin color, and it's not just us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is something that's in the back of my mind. And I think that that is one of the reasons why maybe Asian Americans aren't so open to talking about this issue with other people. As I said, it's sort of embarrassing. You don't necessarily want to share it, but certainly you don't want to give fuel to other groups that, you know, hey, look what you're doing here. That's so racist, or, you know, whatever it might be. So absolutely, I think that that's a really good point. But I also believe we have to talk about it. Nothing's going to change if we don't talk about it. So we can only be worried about other groups. We really can't be worried about what other groups think about it. We have to solve this problem within our own communities.
When women submitted essays for the project, did any of them say it was cathartic to actually sit down and put the words on paper?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, some of the women who wrote for the book said that, you know, actually opened up conversations between themselves and their mothers, for example. There were some women, though, that were still kind of worried when the book came out about how their family members would react, particularly if they wrote about their mother. I'm thinking about one individual. You know, if you wrote about your mother, for example, what is she going to think when she actually reads this? So I think the women were really brave for sharing their stories, because one of the things I did say in the book is it's one thing to talk about ourselves and our own biases and our own experiences, but it's another when we have to involve our family members in these stories because they aren't always the most flattering stories. And even whenever I shared my story, I really thought long and hard about what I would include and what I wouldn't. So to know that there are many other stories these women probably have they may have held close to their vests as well.
Did your parents, as a mixed race couple, have particularly effective ways of talking to you about race and color?
You know, it's so funny. I don't even really think we had these conversations. I think more our conversations were about race. And those were probably limited, but they were more so around race because they were raising their children in the United States. I do talk about in the book that I felt like I was insulated in many ways from colorism because I was raised in part by a white mother. I, you know, lived in a predominantly white community in suburban Atlanta. That's where I grew up. I went to predominantly white school, so I didn't have that necessarily that connection with other Indians, Indian Americans my age, where I might have learned these messages. Having said that, I know from a young age I already understood these messages, so I'm not even sure where they came from. So I think that just really shows how powerful that messaging is about light skin and the preference we give to light skin over dark.
Before I let you go, what did you learn about the ways that Asian American women have found to push back against colorism and love their skin, whatever shade it happens to be?
Yeah, I think women in this book really talk about their journeys to really loving their own skin. That some women talked about how it was a lifetime. I think women in this book are age 22 to 62, and some of the older women talk about how it's really been a lifetime progress to accept their skin. But I'll just leave you with this. One of the things they've said is, I'm doing this for my daughter. Like, I don't want to perpetuate this message to my child. And so some women have really gone out of their ways to counteract those messaging or that type of messaging for their children, in particular, their daughters.
Nikki Khanna is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont and editor of a book of collected essays called Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. Nikki, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you're a podcast person, you can use any podcast app, search for KERA Think, and download the Think podcast. You can also listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.